Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
We forgot to mark Paul Simon's birthday, really, so better late than never. He was 80 last week. And there was a documentary, isn't there, on BBC.
Which was really, really good.
About the
Harmony
making
game. Still on iPlayer, I think. It's so good, made in 2011. I thought that was fantastic. Yeah, I mean, you liked it too, didn't you? It was amazing.
Yeah, it was about the making of Bridge Over Troubled Water. So a certain amount of it was obviously shot at the time. And I tell you what I came away thinking is the thing that with Paul Simon is insufficient focus on. Is the people talk about, you know, wonderful literate songwriter and so forth, and the folk tradition and all this sort of thing. But actually the key thing, the key shaping factor in Paul Simon is brill-building pop music, because that's where he came from. You know what I mean? He was doing this stuff as a teenager, and he's all about tune first over absolutely anything. You know
completely.
What I mean? I've just compiled a little list I've got in front of me, Mark, a little quiz for you, okay? Can you sing the opening verse of Mrs. Robinson? And what are the words?
That's oh, Lord. Da, da,
da, da, da, there you go. It's actually da, D. Da, da, it's da, da, D, 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 D,
I think he does it. There are no words.
That's my point.
It's
what's
a
the
trick
what's
question.
The opening of America? America from Bookend by Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, that's got no lyrics, too.
It starts in.
That's right. That's right.
What's the opening of Slip Sliding Away? Ooh.
Yes, it is.
What's the chorus of The Boxer?
Lila
Lai. Lila Lai, Lila Lai, you know. It's,
which is brilliant, because he said in the documentary that he just couldn't think of any more words, so he just sang Lila Lai, and that becomes the kind of epic build for the whole song.
Absolutely.
My God, can I just say that, what an amazing film. What I loved about that film was the way that they go into the detail of the sound. Is it Roy Haley, the sound
Roy
engineer?
Halley, yes. Yeah.
Roy Haley. And it talks about the detail of how they got the sound on The Boxer. You know, they went off and recorded it in a chapel in Columbia University to get that echo. You know, Cecilia, they went to various college gigs, didn't they?
Yeah.
To record just the clapping of the audience to put onto the album. It's absolutely amazing.
It's extraordinary, Bridge Over Troubled Water, because it's actually, I mean, in terms of the amount of material, it's quite thin, really. I mean, it's got two or three extraordinary songs, Bridge Over Troubled Water being one, and
The Boxer.
The Boxer. But, I mean, a lot of it, you know, it's Bye Bye Love is, you know, Everly Brothers song.
Everly Brothers song. Cecilia is kind of slightly throwaway.
It is slightly throwaway. It's really good, but it's slightly throwaway. El Conde Pasa is, you know, it's an old folk song.
Old folk song, which I think he bought the rights to and then wrote lyrics, didn't he?
Yeah. So in that sense, it's quite thin. But the thing that struck me about it is that it's a real kind of pivotal record, in the sense that it's a record, and it's probably the first one that is about sound rather than songs, isn't it? It's about getting a sound right.
Which is
about
entirely
texture.
What that documentary is about. It's
it
about
is.
Every single bit of it. They work out. If we, Roy talks about going around the studios and clapping. When he hears the best echo, he says to the drummer, set your drums
set
up.
Set your drums up there.
And they record things actually in the echo chamber, don't they?
And the Boxer. The Boxer is an amazing example of this, because it's very few people playing on that. There's Joe Osborne on the bass, and there's Hal Blaine, who's playing his drums out in the stairwell at Columbia, basically, because that's where they can get the echo, you know, so that you hear that extraordinary crashing sound.
Yeah.
It's just him hitting a single snare, but the amount of echo on it. And I think it's a bass harmonica on there as well. And the great Fred Carter plays guitar. But it's quite sparse, really.
It is.
But he's made enormously dramatic by the way it's recorded. And I think it really was a big shift.
The bit on Cecilia where they get a load of drumsticks and drop them on a parquet floor just to get the scattering sound.
Yeah.
And the rhythm track they'd all recorded at a party around at Paul Simon's house. They bring in the cassette, stick it on the studio machinery and tinker with it and use that as a loop, an early loop. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
I thought the detail was fantastic.
It's very good.
My God, what a lyricist he is. Don't you think? I mean, my God. I've squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles. Such a promise. Lies and jests. Still a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest.
Disregards.
And that's a fantastic...
Using the word disregards in the lyric and making it so musical is, it's fantastic. So happy birthday to him.
Happy birthday to Paul Simon. Go back to your 70s records.
Yes, I got asked to do this and by the Radio Times because Dylan Jones, friend of the pod, is doing a two-part thing, I think, on BBC 4 about music of the 80s, celebrating the music of the 80s. And Radio Times were running a piece about this and they just thought, oh, let's get a bit of balance or something. I don't know what. They rang me up. And it's one of those things I've been thinking about it ever since. I thought, if the 18-year-old me had been told that one day, many, many years in the future, somebody would ring up and say, just pick 5 records to represent a decade. Just do it. You know what I mean? Unscientifically. And we're going to run it in one of the highest circulation magazines in the UK, you know, still in this day and age. I would be thrilled to bits. All I could think of at the time was, I've got to get this done quickly because I can't think about it too much. And I actually threw a few. I don't know if I threw a few ideas at you via WhatsApp and our mate Barry Magley and Phil Thomas. I just wanted to see what people came up with, really. You know, it was just a bit of a parlor game.
To have to restrict it to 5 is ridiculous.
Well, except
come on, reveal. I want to know. In no particular or other. They're not in an order at all.
They're not in an order. This is just stuff that, you know, you've got to pick 5 tunes to kind of represent the kind of range of stuff that happened in the 70s and also the kind of lasting legacy of the music of the 70s. I picked, in no particular order, I Feel Love by Donna Summer.
That's a good choice. That's a good choice. Don't stop there. That's because that was, no one had made a record like that before.
Nobody had made a record like
that. That becomes the kind of foundation for, I suppose, for a form of electronic dance music thereafter. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. And Brian, the story goes that Brian Eno took the record into the studio when he was recording with David Bowie in Berlin and said, this is how records will sound in the future. And if he did say that, he was completely right.
He was.
He was completely right about it. And
it's
the thing that interests me about it is going back and listening to it is you know, dance records in the 60s had been about songs. And dance records in the 70s, post I Feel Love, they become about grooves. And actually, the key bit in I Feel Love is where he makes everything disappear apart from the groove. And technologically, you couldn't do that in the 1960s. You couldn't have done that on a Motown record. You know what I mean? Because they were played and recorded in a certain way. Whereas if you're making a record the way Giorgio Moroder was starting to make them in 1976, 77, you could do that. And that's the most attractive bit of the record, is where everything goes away but the groove. So that's one. Okay. Here... another one, and just completely different. You've Got a Friend by Carole King. Clearly the kind of enormous song of 1971, 1972 in her version and James Taylor's version. And Carole King, a genius. And
heralded in the whole era of the singer-songwriter.
Really. There's a whole singer-songwriter.
Whole new record.
But it's also her fantastic knack for simplicity. It was just absolutely remarkable. And the thing that strikes you when you go and listen to that now is if it were done now or in the 90s or the 80s, it would be overdone. It just would be. It would be done again and again. You know, it would be vibrato and huge, great orchestras, and it would be just over the top. Whereas if you listen to it in 1971, it's incredibly modest. That's the amazing thing. The big song of the year was given the most modest possible treatment. So that's my second one. Okay, yeah. So I Feel Love by Donna Summer. You've Got a Friend by Carole King. In no particular order, my third one, Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen. It's far and away the best record Bruce Springsteen ever made. And it's representative of the fact that you got a load of people in the 70s, a load of people came to prominence in the 70s who were massively influenced by the music of the 60s. And so what's interesting about Born to Run is it's sort of remaking the Spectre experience and the Motown experience in the rearview mirror. You know what I mean? It's rather self-consciously deploying the elements of youthful romance to apply to somebody in their 20s. And it's also less a song than a blueprint for a performance. You know, you go and listen to that record, and what absolutely fascinates me is that all the bits where it kind of stops and starts again. And, you know, there's a bit near the end where it stops and he goes 1, 2, 3, and it starts again. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And does, nobody made records like that in the 1960s. You couldn't do that kind of thing in the 1960s. You could do that in the 1970s. And people go and see, you know, when this bloody war is over and if Bruce Springsteen goes back on the road, people would go see Bruce Springsteen and he'll probably do Born to Run. And what they'll want most from the evening 40 years later is that sound. You know, they want to be put back there in that sound. So that's
and also that took him more into a kind of singles market, didn't it? Because you had to, even big albums acts had to have hit singles.
Definitely. It was the way, it was one of the things that, you know, broke him through in the United States, certainly. So number four.
Very good. Okay.
Number four, Exodus, Bob Marley and the Wailers.
I was going to say there has to be a Bob Marley song.
Because the thing that people forget about Bob Marley, and we remember because we were there, is he did everything and he did it all at the same time. You know, the thing about Bob Marley was.
Are you talking about the track here or the album? The track.
I'm talking about the track. In each case, I'm talking about the track.
All tracks.
This is simultaneously a kind of political rallying cry. But it was also a dance tune. You know, it was daytime radio. It was also an NME favorite. All those things were going on absolutely all at the same time with Bob Marley.
And also, that was the point where he got to the kind of biggest mass market, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And the thing that's still amazing is that he was kind of produced from the culture of a strange religious group on the other side of the world, you know, with kind of roots in East Africa and all that kind of stuff. And yet it completely made sense to people absolutely all over the world because of the way he does it. Because Bob Marley had the knack, like Paul McCartney has the knack, of just knowing what a hook was and knowing how to make something memorable. Those things are so tuneful. Those things are so infectious still. So that's Bob Marley.
It is extraordinary. We accepted that religion, didn't we? We kind of we didn't fully understand it. We endorsed the fact that he endorsed it. And
yeah, absolutely.
Became fashionable and cool.
And my final one is Lust for Life by Iggy Pop.
All right, good.
Because the interesting thing about the 70s is there's so many great records in the 70s that weren't hits in the 70s because there wasn't room for them to be hits in the 70s because there were too many other records and too many other, you know, ways of absorbing people's attention. And the amazing thing about Lust for Life is, you know, recorded in 1977 and, you know, it didn't really come to prominence until Trainspotting.
Until Trainspotting, yeah.
Was that 20 years later?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was 77, wasn't it? Because I was just going to say, why haven't you had anything from the late 70s? But you sort of have.
There's loads of things from the late 70s. I mean, Donna Summer's from the late 70s. I Feel Love's from the late 70s.
Oh, was that 70? I thought it was 76. No, maybe not.
Yeah. Well, that's the late 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the latter half of. And the thing about, you know, Lust for Life is you play it again now, and it's damn nearly 15 years later, and you can't go and make that sound anymore. You can't do it. You know, you just, you know, the technology has kind of moved on too fast, too far.
What was it about that sound you're talking about? The kind of, it's analogness. It's
I suppose it probably is. Yeah.
Texture of it.
Yeah. It sounds absolutely out of control. Those are my five. Those are my five to bat against the 80s.
Can you reveal what Dylan's were?
I don't know.
We don't know yet.
I don't know. I've no idea. But anyway, those are my five.
Very good.
People might like to contribute their own and, you know, point out where I'm wrong. I'm sure they will wish to do that.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
I was up very early this morning to take the good lady wife to the tube. And so I was listening to the beginning of the Today program at 6 o'clock this morning. And they were trailing the menu of things and saying, Adele's got a new record out and we're going to find out what the critics think. And I thought, who cares, honestly? Does it make the slightest difference to the success or otherwise of Adele's record what anybody thinks about it, you know, anybody, any kind of inky scribbler? But then it reminded me of a syndrome that we're all very familiar with. You know, you're probably thinking, why do the Today program do these items, you know? And I'll tell you for why. Because,
well, they're doing it to desperately court kind of teenagers or 22-year-olds.
No, nobody's turning on. Nobody goes nowadays. Goes, oh, quick, turn on Radio 4. They're talking about Adele. They're doing it because the people on the programs, they desperately want to play some music in their program. You know, because they've got an hour and it's taken up with speech and they're desperate for anything that is not speech. And so this is why on Radio 4, particularly current affairs programs, they grab desperately any opportunity to feature music because they can play a bit of music for 30 seconds or
which
or
makes a lot of difference on that program.
It's just for
God,
their own,
it breaks up the rhythm.
Their
of it, own personal, relentless, yeah, grim news, and suddenly Adele.
Absolutely,
it's why their Beatles obsession continues unabated.
Yeah. So anyway, that's that. Casey Musgraves, who we were only talking about last week because she'd appeared.
Oh yeah, not eligible for the Country Awards.
She'd appeared.
Now that's interesting. Is that anything to do with it? Because last week,
the Country Awards, Mark. It's not the Country Awards. She's not eligible. Her album is not eligible for the country category, in the Grammy Awards. Now, this is a very different thing. And we've all noticed that over the years that the Grammys just grow new categories absolutely all the time. You know, so that all shall have prizes and every section of American radio shall somehow feel involved. But this is the first case I recall of somebody being told, sorry, you can't be country anymore. You have been in the past. You're not country anymore. And it's just, who's in charge of this? How are they possibly making these kind of judgments? I can't imagine. Can you?
No, I don't know how you define that. She wasn't particularly country anyway, was she?
Well, I don't know. No, she probably...
Although in her appearance on Saturday Night Live, stark naked the other day, she did wear... The only thing she's wearing is a pair of cowboy boots.
Well, there you go.
So
important,
that's a little bit
important,
of association.
Absolutely.
Do you think that incident has in any way affected their judgment? Are they trying to... I don't know. The country music fraternity is quite conventional.
I wouldn't imagine they're trying to get her out of it because they worry she might win it. I suppose, you know, that...
over somebody who is far more authentically country.
Well, because here's the thing about competitions of any kind, whether they're, you know, awards or they're charts or anything, is if you're outside, you want the category to be wider. If you're inside, you want the category to be narrower. That's just human nature, you know. So if you're in the running, you want a narrower category. If you're not in the running, you want it to be wider. And so she's a bit of a victim of that. But it made me think of something that somebody sent me. I asked yesterday, as usual, you know, any agenda items people wanted us to talk about on the podcast. And this is particularly interesting and you know, related to that point. Frosty Morning, but that's how he's known to his nearest and dearest. Why doesn't everybody use their real name on Twitter? I don't know. Frosty Morning, anyway. They're a great pop, blues, rock, folk, and soul artist from both UK and USA. Lots of cross-influencing, originality, etc. But I'm struggling to think of Brit contributions of a similar level in country music. He says, why? And it's a fair point. There aren't any. Are there? There just aren't any.
Because I think so. Well, it's a fundamentally, almost totally American concept, isn't it?
But also, it's an identity thing, isn't it? Music, country music is about that, isn't it? It's about coming from the United States, from certain states,
certain parts of America, dressed in a certain way, kind of rural background.
Yes, and being a kind of regular person.
Philosophy, exactly.
You can't,
and if you come from Rye now,
it's not happening. I'm sorry. It's just not happening. But you might well say the same ought to have applied to kind of, you know, the Animals who came from Wall's End, you know, doing R&B, but it didn't. Whereas country music, it does. And I think Frosty
Morning, you've got to dress a certain way. It just wouldn't look authentic, would it? It would not.
But also, you can't, it's not just dressing a certain way, you know, because if you were to be a British country star, if you can imagine that, and you were to appear, you know, with the cowboy hat and the boots and the pickup truck, and then and you would have to, do you know what you'd have to do? Quite early on in your career, Mark, you would be forced to do the following. You would be forced to appear in a video with...
wearing a cowboy hat.
No, Mark, I'm going further. What's the thing you got to do if you're an American country star? In some video, you have to appear with the American flag.
Yes, I suppose
you have to do it. Because
possibly with an American car.
Because it's kind of interesting, because it spreads outside country, because you could say, and I know I've said this in print before, American solo stars... American music is about America at some level. It is, in a way that British music is not about Britain. French music is not.
Why
about
are Britain. They so obsessed with their own identity?
Well, if you go in an American bookstore, you see 50% of the titles in an American bookstore are called American Soonton, American Carnage, American Dirt. Well, because... well, the idea is this country you've chosen, or your forefathers chose to go to, and it's a concept, and it's a city on the hill, and all that sort of stuff that we're all used to. Just, you know, they absorb that with mother's milk.
They very much like the idea that they live in the center of the universe, don't they?
Of course they do. So, you know, you couldn't have our country star from Reigate or Tynemouth would very quickly be faced with the problem, do I... be photographed with the American flag. And then you would go on a chat show, people go, hang on, you come from Reigate. It doesn't work. You know?
It doesn't.
Doesn't work at all. So it's as simple as that. You know, that's country music dealt with.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
And we're joined by Jeff Rees, whose birthday it is, and Jeff's a Patreon supporter. So he joins us on the... Is it actually
and
today,
many happy returns.
Is it my birthday today, in fact, the 15th,
Good for you. How is that going to be celebrated?
A few drinks with the missus out in town later, I think, yeah.
Right.
And we're staying in a hotel and we're going to my favourite restaurant, so, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow, where is that? Whereabouts?
It's in Swansea. It's called
Fabulous. Good for you.
It's great. She's a vegetarian, but I'm a massive meat eater. A bit like you, Mark, and your Chrissy Hint story there.
The pâté de foie gras.
I
couldn't understand why I had a reputation for being a meat eater. Of course, that's right. And the pâté de foie gras.
Story.
Yeah, followed it by the rare lamb chops. I know.
So, Jeff, it's a custom long established, i.e. we did it last week, for you know, for our birthday guest to propose a subject for discussion or a question you've got or some observation of a popular nature. What have you come up with, Jeff?
Okay, so I've got some questions for individually for David and for Mark. We'll start with Mr. Hepworth. Okay, Queen Elizabeth Grammar School.
Yes.
The coat of arms. What three things are on the coat of arms?
Oh, I don't know. I could tell you the motto. I can't tell you. Oh, God, I don't know. The motto is Turpe Nescire.
That's right. And what does that mean?
It is disgraceful to be ignorant.
That was my next question. Well done, very good.
Can't tell you what's on the badge.
Okay, a lion, an owl, and Bible.
All right, okay, go on.
Okay, from obviously, I'm a big fan of both of yours, and I've listened to all your podcasts for the last 10, 15 years, whatever it is. But Springsteen or Dylan, and why?
Oh, you're asking me?
Yeah.
Oh,
Who's your favorite?
Oh, good God. Favorite? I suppose I probably feel more warmly disposed to Bruce Springsteen, but I probably admire Bob Dylan slightly. Well, I don't know. What do I admire Bob Dylan? But Bob Dylan's contribution is pretty massive and over a long period of time, sustained over a long period of time. Whereas I don't think you quite say the same thing about Bruce Springsteen. But I think Bruce Springsteen is the greatest live performer, and that's right. No small thing. Yeah, that's what I was saying.
What first drew you to Springsteen is the music or the words?
The look.
Okay.
The look of him.
Yes. A street urchin in 1972.
I think the look is always more important than anybody. You know, I think we always talk about music and lyrics, and actually what we really want to do with rock stars is look at them.
Yeah, yeah, right. Okay, two more questions left. Which is the best Silver Seas album?
Oh, the best Silver Seas album is Shatter Revenge.
Okay. And the last question, I think you've said this before, but I'd like to personally ask you about this. What was it like interviewing Sting?
Interviewing Sting. I interviewed Sting a bunch of times. And
I had two. Amazing.
And I interviewed him once in a shower. Backstage at the Tower Theatre in Philadelphia, where he's wearing nothing but a towel, which
cheeky,
somewhat intimidating, you know. And he was in the kind of the high noon of his youthful beauty in those days. You know, you thought, I feel a bit inadequate. So you know, he was fine. He was a show off. And the best interviewees very often are show-offs, yeah.
Right,
I interviewed him in his house in Hampstead after he just moved in. And he was pretty much the biggest pop star on the planet. Like, I remember, it was just me, him, briefly, his little son, and a childminder, and a photographer, and that was it. No agents, no managers, no nothing. Who owned that house before, Dave? Somebody very significant.
I don't know.
Yehudi Menuhin, somebody like that.
Oh, probably. Because the first time I interviewed him, actually, was... I'll go even further back, was when they first broke through with, I don't know, Can't Stand Losing or whatever the first hit was.
Yeah.
I went to interview him and he was living with Frances Tomalty. He's married to Frances Tomalty. And Joe was the first child, you know, and they were living in a basement flat just near Lambert Grove, really kind of modest, you know. There was poverty in those days. and then every time...
Well, they lived in one room, didn't they, with the baby and the caracot for quite a long time.
Tiny place, yeah. And he was, you know, suddenly they were all over, you know, they were on top of the pops and so forth, but he obviously didn't have any money at that stage.
I can remember Adrian Devoy going to interview him for Q on the place he has this estate out in Italy. And he said he'd see as far as the horizon was land owned by Sting.
Yeah.
So things did change pretty fundamentally.
Tell you my favorite nuggets about Sting. I was told this by Sting's publisher. And I interviewed him. I'm fascinated by the fact that people have written loads of songs and had loads of success. In the end, it's one song, really. And I told the publisher, and he said, yes, true. He says, I could go anywhere in the world, check into a hotel, turn on the radio in the room, and within an hour, I'll hear a song by Sting, and it will be Every Breath You Take.
Nearly always one song, isn't it?
It's nearly always one song.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the fascinating thing about that is Every Breath You Take is the dullest idea imaginable without Andy Summers' guitar and Stuart Copeland's drumming. And Stuart Copeland thought it was a stupid song, didn't he? It's a
classic. Yeah, yeah. Andy Summers makes that song.
Hey, Andy Summers incredible completely makes that song. Completely.
Otherwise, they're the most standard chords in the world.
It's a brilliant record. It's a brilliant, it's a genius record. But it's not one man's work.
No.
It's all three of them. And I think that I often think that Stuart Copeland's kind of complete lack of interest in the whole thing makes it work, because he's just sitting there going,
he does
yeah,
nothing.
Will this do?
He just cracks along. There's no frills, nothing. It's fantastic.
It's a brilliant record. Anyway, sorry, that's enough. That's enough on Sting.
That's great. That's lovely. Okay, Mark.
God, okay.
What is so good about Bob Dylan? Because I'm not a fan of Bob Dylan. I've never been into him because I'm a musician first, and then I'm into words after that. And I've never really started with Bob Dylan. I like some of his songs, but I don't like most of the stuff I hear. So why is he so good? And where should I start if I'm going to enter Bob Dylan's world?
Where should you start? I would have thought, God, Blonde on Blonde? Maybe John Wesley Harding. John Wesley Harding's a good place to start. Really simple, really straightforward songs. Three verses, four lines each. Just beautiful song, completely timeless. You don't know what century it's written about. Extraordinary, very simple, very pared down. Just him playing the harmonica and the acoustic guitar, bass and drums. Why is he so good? Bob Dylan, just it's magical, lyrical material. His imagination, his ability to tell stories, the characters he finds in songs, the way he expresses himself. It's kind of poetry set to music. Absolutely extraordinary. I can't think what else to say. Not a dynamic performer in any way, but completely holds your attention. And there's so much variety. You know, he's every form of American roots music is synthesized in Bob Dylan songs. There's folk music, there's jazz, there's jump jive in the later period. There's rock and roll, there's R&B, there's country music. It's fantastic.
The books that you two have made me buy over the last 10 years, which has been numerous and brilliant, and I've loved every one. A lot of the books, the kind of music biographies, they often mention Bob Dylan. I mean, almost everyone does. And it's from any era as well. They always go, oh, I love Bob Dylan. I'm thinking, well, I'm missing a trick here. So perhaps I'll have to check that out. how good are you really on bass?
I mean, oh God.
You always play it down. Come on.
Very average indeed. I can just about manage the great trick, which is to play bass and sing at the same time. And very few people can do that effectively. I mean, by that, I don't mean I can do it anywhere. It's very, very hard to do. And I can just about do it. But if you look at the way McCartney plays the bass on songs like, All My Loving, and sings and winks at girls in the front row, is absolutely incredible. I don't know how people can play the bass guitar and sing at the same time when they're playing, but it's Jack Bruce being a really good example, playing in a different rhythm. Next question. Come on, we don't want to waste any time talking about me playing the bass.
Okay, what was Tony Blair's favourite song to sing in your band?
Oh, my Lord. Tony Blair's
favourite song. As in the cover version, yeah?
Yeah, probably Honky Tonk Women. I would have thought we did a Doobie Brothers, Long Train Running. You love that? We did, I can't remember now. We did a...
That's quite a high song to sing, right, isn't it? Long Train Running? That's in G, isn't it? Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Okay, great. Lovely. This is a quiz question for you then, Mark. What village did Maka arrive in 1968 on his way back to London and kind of did a little impromptu performance in a pub?
God, you know, there's a fantastic description of this in Derek Taylor's book, and I forgot the name of the village, but basically they're tripping, aren't they? Yeah. And they decide to stick a pin in a map and tell the driver of their, I think it's a Rolls Royce or a Bentley that they're in, to take them to that place. And when they arrive, they go to somebody's house. They go to a pub, I think, eventually.
Yeah.
And McCartney plays the piano, and I think plays Hey Jude, but I think he's just written. So I can't remember the name, but you'll have to tell me, Jeff.
It's Harold.
Harold. That's right. Yeah. Double R, isn't it?
I can't believe, you know, the brilliant little comedy film would be about to do a fictionalized version that whole weekend. Because that weekend, they go to, is it Bradford? They go on the first day to make Thingamy Bob with the Black Dyke Mills.
That's right.
And he tries to get the night porter in the hotel to wash his dog. She goes with Martha, the sheepdog, who I think in Derek Taylor's book, Derek Taylor's account of this is fantastic, about really, he wants the night porter to wash the dog and get rid of the clinkers on the nether end of Martha.
And the night porter's thinking, whatever they're paying me, it's not enough. No one's going to
accept
that job.
It would make a really good film.
It would.
So is that last of your questions for Mark?
It is, yes.
Thanks, right. Jeff.
Well, there's some useful things come out of there, I like to feel.
I think so, yeah.
It's good to be put on the spot. So your birthday is today and you're off out this evening. So are you sleeping the rest of the day to recuperate?
No, keep up your strength? I'm going into school to teach, so...
Oh, right. Oh, good grief. Yes, Jeff's a peripatetic guitar teacher. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
You'll be out there doing fine work. Well, lovely to talk to you.
Good for you. And have a good birthday, Jeff. Enjoy the meal.
Have a good birthday. We'll no doubt see you on the quiz.
See you later.
See you soon.
I might be a bit tipsy on the quiz, so, you know.
Okay.
We'll bear that in mind.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
So, questions from the massive. Simon Brock says, box sets, is there anything more worthwhile left to anthologize that hasn't already been anthologized? If not, we'll need a new format so that the labels can make a fresh start. Actually, I'd make one point, Simon. Is that I think the labels are obviously trying to make money out of these things. But what's interesting is the level of public demand for these things. You know what I mean? Is that there are people, not a huge number of people, but there are people who are always just looking for the next, you know, kind of unreleased so-and-so, you know, with the outtakes and, you know, the version that I never got to hear before. And then kind of the more expensive the box is, the things are in, the more people seem to like it. You know, people get a lot of joy out of those things, don't you think, Mark?
The more bits, the all things must pass. The recent George Harrison had the little miniature gnomes. Not that I've got one. I can't remember what it cost. I mean, hundreds of dollars, wasn't it? But there's just something really exciting about this whole little thing being packaged up for you.
And it's also all these people posting videos of them unboxing this stuff, you know. It's kind of...
That's right.
They get a lot of pleasure out of it.
And also, you can't deny that if you're interested in a group, that any outtakes are incredible. And it's very quick tangent. Dave, you were listening to that Let It Be outtakes thing. It's on Spotify this morning.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. I spent about 10 minutes into it. You get them singing Save the Last Dance for Me, sung to the tune of Don't Let Me Down, because they're exactly the same chords. You get them doing Wake Up Little Susie and going into I Me Mine. They do the old rock and roll of The Walk. Billy Preston leads a soul jam backed by the Beatles. That's fantastic.
What's the one that I was looking at it this morning? I'm trying to
you get, Ringo playing Octopus's Garden for the first time, really embarrassed and self-conscious and playing piano. And they're all being really sweet and encouraging him. There's a lovely bit where they're about to go into Polythene Pan, where George Harrison is ordering his lunch from Mal. He says, Mal, can I have the cheese sauce on the cauliflower today?
He's suddenly really keen on cheese sauce.
Yeah, I like to have cauliflower. I like to have cheese sauce. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, that was
where Ringo comes in, they go, Happy New Year. And he goes, Hare Krishna. So brilliant.
The no, the one that struck me was Maggie May stroke Fancy My Chances With You.
Oh yeah, Fancy My Chances With You. It's incredible.
Where's that come from? I've never heard Fancy My Chances before.
It's brilliant.
That's great fun. And of course, it's all out there for you to hear now. If you're so minded, Cruiser's Creek, another catchy name. He bought the new Steely Dan live CD. Didn't know there was one, but okay. And he loves it. But it doesn't feel right that Donald Fagen and his band should be calling themselves Steely Dan. It seems disrespectful to Walter Becker. What do you think?
The question there is that if Walter Becker were alive and for some reason he couldn't do it or he didn't want to do it or whatever and was asked, would he mind, what would you think he'd say? I think he'd say that he would mind.
Yeah,
but the fact that he isn't here means that Donald Fagen is at liberty to do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
And I don't blame him, really. And also, I think it's all right.
And also, Donald Fagen is the voice of Steely Dan.
He's the voice of Steely Dan. He sounds like he can make the Steely Dan sound.
And he wrote, you know, co-wrote.
We're saying it's legit.
I think I'd give him slack, really.
Yeah.
David James says the Stones no longer playing Brown Sugar. And should bands self-edit their past?
God, don't you think in that case, yes?
I think probably yes.
I'm amazed, actually, that what they've done is saying we're not going to play Brown Sugar anymore because they're doing that because before someone else says, the Stones are playing a song about a slavery ship where women are chained up on the deck and somebody goes down and has his evil way with them.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is being celebrated. It's fantastic. Another way, Mick says, we might do it some other time. And Keith goes, I don't really understand what the beef is with the sisterhood here.
It's
absolutely hilarious. I think bang to rights. It is a very, very dodgy song. I'm amazed they've been playing it for so long, actually.
And also, they don't play. They haven't played it as well as they made.
No.
Since the day the record was made, they've never played it as well as the record. But anyway, and also Lee Ward while we're on the subject of the Stones, Lee Ward wants to know what we think of McCartney's quote in the New Yorker about the Rolling Stones, saying he'd always thought of them as just a blues cover band.
Well, that's just him just trying to get a bit of publicity for his new Primrose lyric book. And he's brilliant at it. McCartney's ability to come up with a line. I interviewed him around the time that he was doing for Radio Times, around the time that he was playing the Queen's birthday party at Buckingham Palace. And he said he was going to play Her Majesty. And he came up with a line that the Queen was a babe.
Classic.
He's just put that in the interview because that's the headline. That's what's going to get in all the newspapers. Superb.
Yeah. But I think dismissing the Rolling Stones the Rolling Stones don't have anything like the breadth of the Beatles. But to suggest that they're just a blues cover band is a little bit below the
It's top. A bit mean. But if you look at the things that the Beatles were playing in the early days, you know, you look at the Hamburg days, they were playing Till There Was You, Your Feet's Too Big.
Yes.
You know, Red Cells and stuff, A Taste of Honey, Shake of Araby. Besame Mucho. I mean, they came from kind of music hall and old song ballads and all sorts of traditions that the Stones didn't. Stones came from a narrower background.
Yeah. Tronic Youth says the new Velvet Underground documentary is out this Friday. Is there a band who sold fewer records in their day who have been more influential? Well, probably not. I'll tell you what struck me. I've seen Velvet Underground in response to this. I remember buying a Velvet Underground record. The first time I bought a Velvet Underground record was in W.H. Smith's in Dewsbury in 1970. No, I tell a lie. It was Boots. I'm going further, Mark. It was Boots, okay? So all I'm saying is, if the Velvet Underground had penetrated, you know, the consciousness of the world sufficiently to get into Boots in Dewsbury in 1969, that's quite remarkable, isn't it, really?
You know
what I mean? And so we're talking about how underground they are and how nobody knew about them and, you know, how unpopular they are. Well, you know, it's all relative, isn't it, really? You know, they were always kind of known. People didn't necessarily buy their records, but they were kind of known and they were in record shops and they were reviewed and they were known about, weren't they?
They were. They were written about incredibly extensively, weren't they?
Yeah, and have been for, you know, 50, 60 years. It's just, it's a different kind of
thing. I think ultimately they did sell a lot of records, actually.
They
just
probably
very
did.
Very early on, it's just that first album that didn't, at the time, but subsequently would have sold enormously.
Yeah, probably. Gabe Rosa says, have we noted the passing of Apple Scruff, Lizzie Bravo?
Oh, Lizzie Bravo, what a great story. There was an obituary in the Times. That shows you how big the Beatles are, that one of the Apple Scruffs who sang backing vocal on Across the Universe in whenever it was, 1967, 1968, gets an obituary in the Times. I thought it was such a great story. Yeah. And she was standing, when she was 16, she flew to London, didn't she? With her parents bought her a ticket. She went straight from Heathrow Airport to Abbey Road and stood outside the Beatles recording Sgt. Pepper and basically just stayed there for about 7 months outside, waiting for the Beatles to come in and go. And she sang on that song, and she said, at one point, my heart was, Lennon was singing beside her, my heart was beating so hard, I thought it would actually come out on the record. You'd be able to hear it in the microphone. It's fantastic. Good for her.
And talking of people's hearts beating in that kind of context, will bring us back neatly to the person we were discussing right at the beginning of the podcast, is Paul Simon. And in Paul Simon's 80th birthday reminded me to look once again at one of my favorite clips on YouTube, which is probably the first time I saw a fan being summoned from an audience to sing a song with Star on stage. And that is this clip of this woman called, I think she's called Raina. And he is, people are shouting, and this is a Paul Simon concert from my dad 15 years ago or whatever. People are shouting for songs from the audience, and she must shout, do Duncan, I learnt to play the guitar on Duncan.
And he says, come up and show us.
He says, come up and show us.
And she gets more and more overjoyed and thrilled. First, she's just absolutely terrified. By the end, she's just on it.
She's holding on to herself, like she's hyperventilating. Yeah. Oh, my God, what have I done? You know what I mean? He's going to hand me his guitar and I'm going to have to sing this song.
Yeah, yeah.
And she does it. And so it's a wonderful moment.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.